I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Adema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Dave Broom, who is an internationally acclaimed author, journalist, and consultant specializing in spirits, in particular whiskey. And he has written 10 books, including The World Atlas of Whiskey, and the latest one is The Way of Whiskey, a journey around Japanese whiskey. And Japanese whiskey has become very popular globally in recent years, and some of the brands are hard to get, even in Japan. So today we'll discover the uniqueness of Japanese whiskey, cultural aspects of Japanese whiskey that Dave explores in his book, and fascinating Japanese whiskey producers, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan News is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan News. And please write a review. We'd appreciate your feedback. And also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Now let's start our conversation with Dave Broom. Hello, Dave. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, great to have you here. I've been really looking forward to seeing you because after reading your book, I had so many goosebumps many times. Your book is amazing.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you.
So we'll just discuss your book in details in a moment. But first, where are you from and how did you become a spirits writer?
Right, yeah. From Glasgow in Scotland. You can probably tell from the accent. and I've been writing about drink in general for 30 years now and specialising in spirits really since 1995, 1996. It's kind of right place, right time. Prior to that, I worked in a wine shop, did wine exams, worked in Australian wineries, ran a pub, and then got a job writing about booze in general.
Mm.
And then when I went freelance, kind of realised that in those days, this is kind of the mid-90s, that the whole cocktail culture was beginning to take off in London.
Mm.
Single malt was actually beginning to grow, and there was a lot of interest in spirits in general, but at that time there were only three other people writing about it, whereas there was about 300 people writing about wine. So not only was I interested in it, but I could actually be able to get articles placed.
Interesting.
So it was kind of right place, right time, really.
And also the internet started to be more explosive too.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I do remember, you know, in the early days when I was kind of doing research, historical research or whatever for books, you know, it was very hard to get sources, the industry was perhaps slightly less willing to give up what they viewed as being secrets.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's so much easier now, especially to get archival stuff, you know, to go onto the web, and rather than having to go to the British Library, you can actually get a lot of historical documents much more easily now. So it makes my life a lot simpler.
Mm. Okay. And so I heard that you've been to Japan 30 times in the past 16 years in studying, learning about whiskey. So what brought you to Japan in the first place?
Well, I cut a couple of things. One was, I mean, Japanese whiskey began to be exported to the UK in the late 90s. Yamazaki, then Hakushu initially, then Nikka came in. And there was beginning to be a buzz about Japanese whiskey at that point. And then I was working for a magazine called Whiskey Magazine at that point. Mm. And they put on a whiskey show, which kind of wanted this kind of new concept. I think, you know, people in a room drinking whiskey was kind of a weird thing. And they put one on in Tokyo and invited myself and my dear friend and mentor, Michael Jackson, to come over to give talks there. And that was my first visit to Japan. And I'd wanted to go to Japan for a whole host of reasons prior to that.
Right.
That's where it started. So I was already in love with Japan, and I was head over heels in love by the time I left.
Mm. Right. So, but how did you, like, you know, you went to Japan and you knew, you know, Yamazaki, Hibiki, those, you know, classic, the beginning of Japanese whiskey culture. But why you got so interested in Japanese whiskey when you visited?
Well, yeah, I think it kind of happened pretty much on that first day when I was at Yamazaki with the blending team and tasting the whiskies and really tasting them properly for the first time. Mm. So rather than just having kind of one glass of, you know, a single malt, suddenly you've got different component parts and different casks and different ages. And suddenly the range began to become more apparent. And I asked them, you know, how do you describe the characteristic of Japanese whiskey? And a gentleman called Masumi Nabe said, well, we describe it as having transparency. And that just hit me. You know, there was a resonance to that. And I said, well, okay, right, so what does this transparency mean? And I understood kind of intuitively what he meant, because the range of aromas, the way that flavor and aroma is demonstrated within Japanese whiskey is fundamentally different to the way it exhibits itself in Scotch. And that was kind of my in, trying to unpick what this transparency was. And I was kind of a bit of a whiskey geek about it and thought it was all to do with just process.
Mm.
And then the more I looked, the more I understood that it was actually part and parcel of a Japanese cultural aesthetic. You know, it was linked to traditional craft. It was linked to the way that people make, you know, not just food or sake or whatever, but also ceramics or knife work or whatever. I just went down further down the rabbit hole, if you like.
Right. So, I think it's a package, meaning, like, so Japanese whiskey, people say it's modeled after Scotch, but then the Scottish whiskey culture is different from Japanese whiskey culture because it's a whole package.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the number of the book, basically. You know, that's the theme, that whiskey is a cultural product. We tend to think, I think everybody now realizes that food is a cultural product, but drink somehow, maybe wine, people appreciate there's a wine culture, but spirits, I think, have been, because they've been sold as brands, people have not really, the dialogue hasn't been set up to be able to talk about spirits as actually having some cultural background to them. But they do. And that's what I wanted to explore. And exactly your point, you know, I mean, I always say, and it sounds kind of glib, but, you know, the Japanese make the best Japanese whiskey in the world. And the Scots make the best Scotch. And they are fundamentally different for a whole number of reasons, and it could be climate, and it could be, you know, what is growing there, and it could be technique, but at its heart, it's actually how it fits within a wider culture, and Japanese culture just impinges and influences flavor and occasion and everything, so
right.
So yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the cultural thing. So first, what about the history of Japanese whiskey? What's the history, like brief history of Japanese whiskey?
Yeah, a very brief history of Japanese whiskey. So whiskey first gets imported into Japan when Japan is opened up to the West. And Scotland becomes very important in terms of establishing heavy industry in Japan. So there's lots of very rich trading links between Scotland and Japan in the late 19th century. And a lot of imported whiskey, imported spirits in general, began coming in. Japanese distillers began trying to do imitations of that, and then realized by the 1919 roughly that why not try and actually make it themselves rather than trying to fake it. And so the first distillery, which was Yamazaki, was built in 1923, began making whiskey by Suntory, and made, you know, the first whiskey appeared in 1928. So, you know, but it's not, it wasn't really exported because Japanese had an insatiable thirst for whiskey, especially in kind of post-war period. And it was drunk. Everything was drunk in the domestic market. So when it appeared in the export markets in the 90s, everybody went, oh, it's a new kid on the block. It's actually been made since the 1920s. And, you know, so we're kind of playing a massive game of catch-up to some extent.
Interesting.
But it's been a fascinating way in which the whiskey culture has developed in Japan and had its own very individual personality and its own, the distillers have their own unique way of looking at how to create flavours and how to make whiskies which appeal to a Japanese palate and Japanese sensibilities. And, you know, the technique came from Scotland, but the application of it is Japanese.
Right, so how do you, we're going to talk about those each distilleries later, but what is the characteristics of a Japanese whiskey versus other countries' whiskies?
I would say, kind of coming back to that transparency, they have an aromatic intensity and a clarity, which you don't see in Scotch. It's not that they're more complex, it's just the nature of the complexity is different. So I think you just get to see, they're slightly more restrained than Scotch, certainly more restrained than bourbon. You know, bourbon kind of shouts and says hello, you know, it's very, you know, and that's what bourbon does, and it's not a restrained or shy spirit. Scotch isn't necessarily very shy either. Scotch is also quite bold, and Japanese whiskey has just got this restraint and as I said, kind of aromatic intensity to it. I describe it as being like the difference between Scotch whiskey is like a mountain stream, you know, and all the flavours are kind of bouncing about all over rocks and everything. And it's kind of hard to discern exactly what's happening. Whereas in Japanese whiskey, it's like a clear pool and you can actually see everything very clearly in front of you. And the other kind of fundamental difference between Japanese single malt and Scotch is that Japanese single malt tends not to have a cereal character, so it doesn't have that kind of dry nuttiness which Scotch does, sometimes overtly, but it's usually there in the background of Scotch, and Japanese distillers, for using various techniques, deliberately try and avoid having that, and that helps to promote that very, very clear, intense aroma.
So the subtlety makes things clear, like water.
Yes,
clear.
Yeah, it does, and it also then ties into Japanese culture, so then it ties into food, and it ties into this idea of Japanese term shibui, which is restraint, which is elegance, which is, you know, being understated, not ostentatious, allowing the ingredients to show themselves, which, you know, underpins Japanese food, but also underpins tea, underpins, you know, ceramics, everything, the Japanese decor, Japanese architecture, you know, and that's why whiskey is part of that. You know, and that is there in the background all the time. That's the one reason why Japanese whiskey becomes Japanese, because all of a sudden that element comes into play.
Right. One of the reasons I really liked your book is, you know, the page of shibui, explaining shibui concept. I've never seen anybody that's done so well.
Oh, thank you. It was quite. I was suddenly aware. You know, here you have somebody from Scotland trying to describe Japanese aesthetics, and that's kind of that's kind of arrogant, really. Or potentially getting it badly wrong.
No, but there's another right next to it. I think the page after that was Wabi Sabi, which is really like perfect. And I'm going to quote your words from there.
Thank you. Yeah, Wabi Sabi. I was trying to, I think I say in the book, I was trying to avoid Wabi Sabi all the way through because it's so hard to try and explain. But I think shibui is a good one. But yeah, ultimately you end up with Wabi Sabi. So, what I realize in Japan is that every time you ask somebody about Wabi Sabi, they come up with a different answer. So I was quite confident that I could just like throw in something else.
That's the culture.
Yeah, that is culture.
Right. Yeah, but I have to quote this one. So it's in your book, The Way of Whiskey, you say Japanese whiskies have aromatic intensity unlike Scotch, and they are paradoxically managing to be vivid yet delicate, salty, subtly powerful. And the flavors are ordered, complex, and seamless, on the tongue, and they had a clarity and precision. And some were familiar with Scotch, but the manner in which they presented themselves are different. So,
yeah.
That's beautiful. And
thank
I
you.
Got more interested in the Japanese whiskey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, so, yeah, so one of the things you find as one of the elements of Japanese whiskey is the Mizunara. So what is Mizunara and what is so unique about?
Okay, Mizunara is a Japanese term for Japanese oak. So it's a species of oak, and there's kind of a still slight debate as to which particular subspecies of oak it is. Could be Quercus mongolica, or it might be a different one entirely. And it gives a unique characteristic. You know, so think about it this way. You know, 60%, roughly speaking, of a whiskey's flavour is coming from the interaction between the spirit and the oak. So the oak's got an important part to play in terms of flavour creation. And each species of oak has a different flavour. So American oak is very rich in vanilla. European oak is quite rich in kind of dried fruit and spice and tannin. And Japanese oak, after about 20 years in cask, you get this incredible smell of incense. And it's the smell of a Japanese temple, which is very handy for people who've been to Japanese temples to say, but if you've never been to a Japanese temple, it's a bit obscure. but it's the smell of aloes wood, oud, and it's very, very intense. And there's also quite a lot of coconut in there as well when it's younger. And it's just one of these key markers that say, this is different. You know, this kind of really takes you off into a different aromatic world. It's quite rare. It's very hard to cooper. It leaks. You know, whiskey makers don't like using it because it doesn't make very good casks because the whiskey flows out of it. But from an aromatic point of view, it's incredibly important. The problem with it is that in Japan, that there hasn't been the same degree of kind of organized forestry that you get, say, in Europe, you know, where you have planned forests from France from the 16th century onwards, or in America, where you also have planned forestry going on. So all the Mizunara, which is being felled at the moment, is kind of wild.
Wow.
And very old trees, so they have to be about 150 years before you can even cut them down.
Wow.
And there's not a lot of it about, so it tends to drive price up. Distillers are now beginning to plant Mizunara, so for every one tree they cut down, they're planting another three. So, listen up, folks. You know, in 100 years, 150 years' time, you'll be able to drink lots of Mizunara casks, you know. Just keep drinking whiskey, you might live that long.
It's a medicine.
Yeah, exactly. But no, actually, it's an interesting one because that's what whiskey's about. Whiskey's about, it's a long-term spirit, you know. Trees take 100 years, 150 years to mature, you know. So what you're doing now is actually laying down fundamentals for people, you know, in a century's time.
Right.
It's incredible.
Right. You know? And not to mention whiskey itself takes 20, 30 years if you are patient.
Yeah, you know, your whiskey can take, you know, a long time. You're going to be put in the cask. You're not going to be taken out of the cask for maybe, 3 years conceivably at the youngest, but considerably longer for some, yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about your book. So, The Way of Whiskey, why did you decide to write this book?
Because I wanted to kind of challenge myself, to be honest, to a certain extent. I'd written some whiskey books in the past, and whiskey books for me were just becoming a little formulaic. Not they weren't good, but it was kind of, you know, you had the history chapter and then you had the production chapter and then you went through every distillery and your tasting notes and it was all good and it was relevant and it was important and, you know, it was exciting stuff. But I wanted to kind of get under the... I began getting obsessed about this cultural aspect, to be perfectly honest. I thought, okay, right, let's just test myself with trying to explore Japanese whiskey in a different way. And the great thing was a good friend of mine called Stefan van Eyken at the same time was writing a book about Japanese whiskey, and I knew Stefan's approach was going to be much more of that real in-depth technical side, which I didn't really want to stray into. So I thought, well, that's great because, you know, there's a clear division between the books. His book is absolutely fantastic, and it allows me to actually go in this what might seem a slightly more unusual route for a whiskey book, but I just thought it was relevant because I read great, books about food. and food writers are allowed to do that, and wine writers are kind of allowed to do that, but spirits writers haven't been allowed to do that, really. Perhaps we just haven't allowed ourselves to do it. So it was just, you know, dipping my toe in the water and seeing. So that was the impulse. That was the genesis of the book.
Like you described, it's an unusual whiskey book because, you know, usually like you said, history and definition and tasting notes and this bottle probably is paid by this company, like that kind of thing. But this is a book of your journey in Japan. Yeah. As if I'm traveling with you at each distillery. So I really...
Yeah, it was kind of different in that respect. I must admit, you know, the initial pitch for the book, it was nothing like the book ended up, you know, which is a good thing, actually. I think, you know, things change. And it was about halfway through the trip I realised that, which I did with this amazing photographer called Kohei Take. He's a really dear friend, and you know, this is a collaboration. The book is very much a collaboration between the two of us. And I sort of realised, remember we were sitting down having a drink, and I went, I've kind of worked it out. I know what the book looks like now, and the book is actually this journey. You know, so it starts on that day when I arrive, and it finishes when I leave. And the story, you know, the narrative is the trip. So the history of Japanese whiskey is there, but it's kind of dotted around throughout the book. And the kind of the deepening appreciation and questions about culture are kind of dropped in as I'm beginning to ask them to people and to craftspeople as well. I think that's the other element that's different, that I'm not just speaking to distillers, I'm speaking to, you know, potters and that amazing woman that makes architectural washi and pewter and, you know, all these different craftspeople.
Right. So so many cultural aspects, and I really enjoyed that. Yeah. Even izakaya to some little important
Chef Hashimoto, who's just, you know, I've been to a few Michelin star restaurants, and they're usually pretty serious places. And this is one of the most hilarious restaurants I've ever been to. You know, it was a joy to sit there. He kept playing tricks on us, you know, by serving us his whiskey kaiseki. And you know, the first course was, you know, the beer. You always have a beer to start a meal before you go, and he served us this beer, and I said, oh, that's fine. And then we were taking a sip, and he went, it's actually whiskey. And it was great. It was a joyous evening. But I learned so much about kaiseki from him as well, and then how that fits into to that whole web.
So the book's title, The Wave of Whiskey, is translated in Japanese as Whiskey Do. And here, Do is used in the same manner as Judo, Kendo, Kado, Sado.
Yeah.
And all those, whatever includes the spiritual aspects in their practice. So why did you name it as Whiskey Do?
Whiskey Do came really from another good friend of mine, a man called Mike Miyamoto, who works for Suntory, was former manager at both their distilleries and brand ambassador and everything. And we were having a drink after a visit to Hakushu, and I was asking him, I was thinking, of what makes Japanese whiskey Japanese? Which is kind of the question I asked everybody. He went, because it's made in Japan. And I went, yeah, great, thanks. and he said, no, because everything that we do is with a Japanese sensibility. You know, it's just part and parcel of who we are. And it was him who then said, you know, we approach everything as do, you know, whether that's flower arranging or tea or whatever, you know, martial arts, whatever. And whiskey, our approach to whiskey is whiskey do. You know, it is the way of whiskey. And it's not about production, and it's not about process. It's about nature. It's about craft. It's about respecting ingredients. Which I would say a different slant on the concept of whiskey making and distilling to his colleagues in Scotland. And it's not right or wrong. That, you know, there's a Scottish way of making whiskey, and there's a Japanese way of making whiskey. And it was kind of when he said that, I thought, well, that's good. I'm on the right way, because, you know, this is deeper than it may seem. It's not just people making a spirit. It's actually people almost intuitively using the same underlying principles that exist all across all of Japanese craft to make whiskey. So it's thanks to Mike that ended up being called Whiskey Do.
That reminds me of Mr. Shinji Fukuyo, the chief blender at Suntory. he's the fourth generation, I think, after Miyamoto-san maybe. But so on his episode 97, he said his way to, you know, to talk about whiskey was like a never-ending pursuit of perfection,
yes,
improvement.
Yes,
so that's
absolutely
the dough.
Yeah, and it's like Kaizen mentality, you know, that incremental continued improvement, which again is a fundamental difference between Japanese and Scotch. You know, a Scotch distiller will say, I want to make my whiskey consistently, which is very difficult, but make, you know, the same whiskey taste the same today and tomorrow and the day after all the way into the future. And distillers such as Fukuyo-san or, you know, any of his colleagues, you know, Ichiro Akuto, whatever, will say, well, actually, no, that's not what we want to do. We want to improve continually. Mm. Knowing that perfection is never out there, accepting chance, accepting innovation, but always moving it forward. And I think that's what makes it really, really exciting for me.
Right.
And I think that's one reason that Japanese whisky making is now becoming such a focus for a lot of new distillers around the world, who perhaps a decade ago would have looked to Scotland as having a template and are now beginning to look at a Japanese approach.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So the reverse.
Yes.
Export
kind
of import.
Yeah, and a lot of Scots distillers are kind of, there's a lot of real great innovation taking place in Scotland. But a lot of that has been driven by, oh, hang on a minute, this is what is happening in Japan. And obviously, you know, with you know, investment and ownership of distilleries in Scotland by Japanese firms such as Suntory or Nikka, there's a lot of cross-fertilisation discussion between the two countries, it's a very open field. You know, people do exchange information a lot. So those avenues of communication are open now.
So it's win-win for the industry of whiskey.
Yeah, absolutely. And win-win for whiskey drinkers.
Right.
Yeah, which is even more important.
That is true. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about great distilleries Dave features in his book, The Way of Whiskey. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Dave Broom, who is an internationally acclaimed author, journalist, and consultant specializing in spirits, and in particular, whiskey. He just published a great book, The Way of Whiskey. So you have visited multiple whiskey distilleries in Japan, and the book features them as like the one of the most beautiful things that exist. And each chapter really was so beautifully written.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So so maybe you can share some of the featured distilleries. Yeah. For instance, I was very interested in Venture Whiskey in Chichibu.
Oh, in Chichibu, yes. Yeah, it's an amazing distillery. So it was founded by a man called Ichiro Akuto, whose family have been making sake in Chichibu for, I think he's like the 14th generation or 15th generation. So, you know, they kind of know about booze. And the distillery is about 10 years old now. So it's relatively new. It was the first of the new wave of distilleries to open up in Japan. And Ichiro's just got this wonderfully holistic view of what whiskey can be and what a distillery can be in the future. So, as well as a lot of the, for example, the vast majority of barley, which is used from the making of whiskey, is imported into Japan because not a lot of barley is grown in Japan. So it's coming from Scotland or Australia or Finland or wherever. And what Ichiro did was, well, hang on a minute, we have got fields around here, we've got farmers around here growing soba for noodles. Can they also grow barley? So they're now growing barley for him. Mm-hmm. There's peat locally as well, so he can begin to use local peat. There's potentially mizanara in the forests around Chichibu as well, which he could perhaps do that. Mm. And it's just a wonderfully energetic distillery. It's basically run by a whole bunch of young kids who are whiskey lovers and who want to know everything there is to know about whiskey. So they know how to plant. They know how to plant and harvest and cereal barley. They know how to do all the malting. They need to know every single aspect of whiskey production.
Mm.
And it's just, it's a genuinely thrilling place to be. And the whiskey's great, but it's a genuinely thrilling place to be because it really is, it's kind of rooting whiskey distilling right in the Japanese landscape once more. And I think that's kind of one of the great themes about 21st century whiskey, not just in Japan, but around the world. The importance of locale, the importance of place. And he's really, taking this forward in Japan. So, right. Yeah, he's an amazing man and very funny as well.
Mm.
Yeah, so well, it's good. I always like going drinking with Ichiro.
Okay. So he... I heard he almost lost his business because the family lost the business.
Yeah, the family began making spirits in kind of 1940s, began making whiskey relatively late on in a distillery called Hanyu, which is kind of in between Chichibu and Tokyo. And they kind of began making whiskey at exactly the wrong time. They began making whiskey just when the domestic market was going into decline. And Hanyu was quite a big, quite heavy whiskey. Which didn't necessarily appeal to the Japanese palate. The whiskey was great, but it was just like, did it appeal to the Japanese palate? And the distillery closed down in the year 2000 and was demolished. Thankfully, he managed to save the stock. There's not much of the stock left. He's kind of been eking that out. And then said, right, I still want to make whiskey. And at that point, began looking around and found the land and everything for Chichibu and built the distillery.
Mm. Yeah. So terroir, that's the...
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's one of these words that's kind of slightly difficult to use with whiskey, for it doesn't apply in the same way as it does with wine, but I think it does exist. And he's going perhaps deeper into terroir than a lot of other larger Japanese distillers who... We'd find it difficult because of size and scale. But if you look at the other new distilleries which are opening up in Japan, such as Akeshi, which is on the east coast of Hokkaido, they are applying very similar principles with local barley, local peat, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of a new movement within Japanese distilling. It's really exciting. Really exciting.
That's great.
It's also allied more to sake, you know, to Nihonshu.
Right. Well, we talked about this and kind of like a knowledge exchange, philosophical exchange between Scotland and Japan, and now that's global, but the localizing is happening too. That's exciting.
I think that's what's so exciting about spirits at the moment, it's kind of understanding. It was a French whiskey maker said it to me, you know, the whole thing about terroir is understanding your constraints. You know, it's sort of saying, you know, this is what I can't do, you know, so therefore I know what my limits are. And I'm going to exploit what these constraints are. I think that's a lovely way to look at it. There are certain things that you can't do and perhaps shouldn't do because that's not what your climate... You'll be working against climate. You'll be working against what cereals can grow or whatever. So, yes, it's a global market these days, but I think within that global market, the local becomes more important because that's where the individuality lies.
Right. But understanding your constraints, that applies to human life too.
It does, yeah. it does. You know, it's kind of weird to have kind of philosophical constructs in a book about spirits, but hey, why not?
I think that makes sense.
Oh, good. That's two of us. That's all right. Yeah. I'll take that.
So the other one, what about Mars? Mars?
Mars, yeah.
Honbo Shuzo. Yeah. I don't think I've tried it ever.
Mars, yeah, it's quite hard to find. There is some in the US. I've done some in tastings, but it's very limited. Yeah, really interesting story. It can be quite complicated, long story, but to cut to the chase. Again, it was a distillery which opened up relatively late on, just as the market was going into downturn. and a tiny little distillery with a very strange name, which again is an interesting story. And it closed down 90. It was closed for almost 20 years. Mm. And then restarted in 2012, with a huge, therefore a huge hole in stock. So they had limited amount of really old stuff and then started off basically afresh. Mm. Same shape of stills, but bigger stills. So they're making slightly more whiskey, but still quite a small distillery. But I think the wonderful thing about Mars is that it always made a very sweet whiskey. It's a lovely, lovely drop. Mm. But when they opened up, reopened the distillery, they went, and I think this is very Japanese, they went, well, we're not going to make what we made beforehand. It's still going to be identifiably Mars because, you know, this is where we are, but here's a chance for us to move things forward.
Mm.
So they're looking at different yeasts, they're looking at different peating levels, different cut points. So at the moment, it's still this kind of hotbed of experimenting going on there to find really what the key signature flavors of Mars are going to be. And there's some brands coming out that are available in over here, but as I said, in limited quantities, which are a blend of a very small amount of that very old stock and some of the new stock coming out. So, but watch out for them. It's a great distillery, and it's just got such a crazy name as well. I find myself saying, you know, when I went to Mars, and people kind of look at me. You really have lost it this time, Dave. No, honestly, it's a distillery. Yeah.
No chocolate bar. But it's interesting, right? Like, Japanese tradition is very strictly traditional, but there's always an element to tweak around, improve, and make it new all the time.
Absolutely. And this was kind of brought out by this lady, Eriko Horiki, who does this architectural washi. And I was talking to her about innovation, because what she's done with paper, with traditional paper making, is really radical. You know, she makes huge pieces, dyed in different colours, sometimes with holes deliberately punched through it, which it runs counter to everything that traditional paper was meant to be, which is, you know, as pure and as white as possible. And I was asking her about this idea of innovation and about this concept, which I think is a Western concept of Japanese of tradition, which is it has remained the same for 400 years. Mm. And she went, well, no, because, you know, the today's tradition was yesterday's innovation. Mm. And today's innovation is going to be the tradition of the future. But things continually move on. And they have to move on, otherwise it dies.
Mm.
I think you see that with culture and tradition and craft all around the world, that if innovation doesn't take place, then it simply just begins to disappear.
Mm.
And that was a really important lesson for me to try and get into that very question. You know, you get everybody thinking, well, it's fixed. So, but if it's fixed, how is it changing? Mm. But that is part and parcel of what it means, and it's kind of coming back to the way thing,
right?
You know that you know your fundamental principles. You know that you're kind of going straight down these train tracks.
Mm.
This is how you make whiskey, and this is a tradition that's been passed down from master to apprentice, blah blah blah, all the way down. But unless you actually step off that path into the wildness, you're not going to innovate. You're not going to accept chance. You're not going to work in that world of creativity, and the creativity kind of sits off to one side, and you've got to kind of leap off into the wild to get that creative impulse and then take things forward, but never ignoring the principles of your tradition, but always asking, always kind of deviating off into the wild. It's good. It's quite zen.
Bit profound.
That was Gary Snyder that told me that. So that wasn't me.
but again, your book contains a lot of, those deep aspects of Japanese culture.
Yeah.
So I really love that.
Well, hopefully there's some jokes in there as well, though.
Yeah, that's for sure. So the another one, I think we should talk about Nikka whiskey, because
it's absolutely.
Always the Suntory was always the history and everything, but the Nikka was always there too.
Nikka's got an incredible story. You know, it was founded by a man called Masataka Taketsuru, who was sent across to learn whiskey making in Japan, in Scotland rather, in 1919. And he arrived in Glasgow when there's tanks on the street of Glasgow because there was a potential Bolshevik revolution going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed in Glasgow learning chemistry. He was a chemist, but he took chemistry courses. And in that 18 months, he worked at three different distilleries and married his landlady's daughter. You know, and that's pretty good going, you know. And he came back as the only person in Japan with an understanding of how whiskey was made.
Mm.
And he then became distillery manager at Yamazaki under Tori-san, and then went off in the 1930s to found his own company called Nika, which is based in Yoichi, which is on an obscure part, especially in those days, on the west coast of Hokkaido. So as far away from the main markets as you could get. And always making a style which was slightly richer, slightly fuller than the more restrained aspects that you get in Suntory, but still with that identifiable Japanese character. And Nika just make absolutely fantastic, fantastic whiskies. Two distilleries, really leading the way in terms of grain as well, grain whiskey with coffee grain, coffee malt. So fantastic, fantastic company.
Well, it's interesting, right? So it used to be only Suntory and Nika, like when I grew up, and but now there's so many new distilleries. So why now more young distilleries?
Yeah, I think there's another kind of sleeping giant in there as well, which is Kirin, which is Gotemba. So owned by Kirin, you're a massive brewer. And fingers crossed, you'll begin to see that appearing on the export markets as well. And they're a fairly substantial producer, actually. Jota Tanaka is the blender there, makes amazing, amazing whiskey. But yeah, I think there's just been a global boom in whiskey. And there was a boom in Japanese whiskey, but then also a lot of what we used to wrongly call craft distillers began to spring up all around the world. And various folk in Japan kind of went, well, we should be part of that as well. They were perhaps slightly later off the mark than others. I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, over the past couple of years, there's been a real rash of new openings in Japan. So I think it's a very, very exciting future ahead. So and all that'll all do something slightly different, but you know, underpinning it all will be a sense of Japanese-ness. But you know, greater variation, a lot, perhaps more attention to the local, using different grains, perhaps using local paste. I mean, there's a whole world of possibilities for Japanese whiskey. It's great,
right.
Really exciting times.
Yeah, it was noticeably like over the I would say several years. You know, if you go to liquor shop, there's more bigger section of Japanese whiskey, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, it's hugely exciting,
right.
And people are now. I think people are just more willing to try new things. To be honest, I think that the days of, you know, I am a whiskey drinker, so I only drink. My dad was a whiskey drinker, and you know that's what he drank. He had one drink of whiskey every night, and I think people are now. You know, they'll be drinking beer one day. They might have whiskey, but it won't necessarily be one style. It could be, right, today I'll have a bourbon, tomorrow I'll have Irish, the day after I'll have a Japanese. But I might also have a gin at some point, I might have rum. So I think people's tastes are much more Catholic these days.
Right.
So there's a lot more of people dipping in and out and just becoming fascinated by flavour.
So do you think that's why Japanese whiskey became so popular globally?
I think it became popular for its grain, you know, because it has incredibly high quality, you know, so it tasted good. You know, we always kind of forget that. I think it benefited from just the general global interest in all things Japanese and Japanese cuisine. So, you know, the fact that, you know, it is, you know, as you said at the top of the show, it's more to Japanese food than just sushi. But, you know, I think that kind of deepening interest in Japanese cuisine, you know, spills off into what else is out there. So you see a growth in people, in sake, for example, and certainly whiskey has benefited from that as well.
Right. Well, somebody behind the bottles sacrificing or devoting their lives to...
Yeah, it's a really good point that, you know, it's made by people. You know, it's not made by machines. You know, it is the people who are passing on their knowledge from one generation to the next.
I just remember that Fukuyo-san of Suntory, when I came to the show, he said he wakes up every day at 4 because he has to travel. He's based in Osaka.
Yeah.
He goes to go to Tokyo. And then when you travel, you have to get up earlier. So just not to mess with your palate every day, with circadian rhythm. So he gets up 4 o'clock every morning, so that it doesn't matter if he goes to Tokyo or not.
Yeah,
so.
I know. He's such an extraordinary man, and they have the same. He and Koshimitsu-san, who he took over from, have the same lunch every day.
Mm. Oh wow!
Yeah. So, you know, you go to the canteen at Yamasaki, they will, you know, it is the blender's lunch.
Mm.
So that is always the same, so every day. So their palate hasn't been affected by different foods. So if they're working in the blending lab, boom, that's what you have.
Mm.
You know, and, I don't see that happening in Scotland. You know, it's kind of, oh, today's a steak pie, tomorrow it's, you know, something else.
Right. Well, that's a big sacrifice. But I'm sure that it's compensated by drinking great whiskeys every
day. Yeah.
Right. By the way, when you go to Japan, where do you hang out to have a great scotch, not the Japanese whiskey?
Oh, if I'm in Tokyo, I go to a bar called Zoetrope, which has just got the largest collection of how does he describe it? Horigami-san says it's Western-style Japanese distilled spirits. And that's amazing. So you just find Japanese whiskies, which you basically can't see anywhere else, and some very old bottlings as well. Not all of which are great. Actually, it's a very instructive place to be. So I like kind of hanging out there.
Mm, so just Zoetrope, it's in the book, but Zoetrope.
Yeah.
In Shinjuku. And I heard it's like a very dark back street.
I quite like kind of dark back streets. I go kind of high end as well. So I go to Bar High Five, to Star Bar. I always go to Star Bar in Ginza.
Mm.
It's Japan. I mean, you know, it's there's a bar around every corner. That's what's amazing about it. The bar scene is so different. You know, comparing. What's happening in Tokyo, but even comparing Shinjuku to Ginza or Shinbashi, you know, that you've got three very different vibes going on there.
Totally.
Yeah, you know, and I like kind of Japanese dive bars. They're a lot of fun. But then you go to Osaka and suddenly the bar scene is completely different. It's much more hectic. It's much more, you know, up there. It's in your face. And then Kyoto is, you know, very Kyoto. So it's a bit more kind of restrained, but a lot of innovation taking place with cocktails, especially in Kyoto. I hang out in loads of places.
I'm curious, how do you describe Japanese, the Tokyo-style dive bar?
It's probably more sake being drunk than whiskey. Well, yeah, I mean, it's perhaps like somewhere like Golden Guy to a certain extent, you know, which is like two city blocks with about 200 bars in them. All of which are themed in a slightly different way. So, I spent an evening in the Hard-Boiled Fiction bar. And you know, it's not much. This studio is like twice the size of a bar in Golden Guy.
Mm.
You know, you can maybe fit five or seven people huddled around a bar just talking about one very specialist subject. I'm trying to think. There's a chain of bars called Abbott's Choice, and there's one up in Roppongi, and it's the bar where bartenders go to drink after their shift has finished. So it's one of these places you can go at like 4 o'clock in the morning and you know, after a shift, and it's just people kicking back, relaxing, and it's beer, and it's kind of dive bar vibe, but in a kind of Tokyo way. But they've got 200 whiskies behind the bar.
Wow. What's the name again?
It's called Abbott's Choice.
Abbott's Choice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. By the way, that Golden Guy, I think it used to be like tons of Brussels.
It was very much a red light district. It's not that anymore, I hasten to add, just in case my wife is listening.
There's an illegal to have like prostitutes and all those things over there. So then it turned to be, you know, the bar section of the town, and then a lot of famous writers and artists started together. So it's completely became cultural.
Yeah, it's kind of one of in some ways it's kind of the original hipster, the hipster area of Tokyo. You know, it's kind of it was the Brooklyn of Tokyo.
So your wife can now relax.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah,
relax. Right. So how do you think how relevant is the role of all those bars, you know, the drinking, bartenders to, you know, all those establishments' role to support whiskey culture?
Oh, very much so. And I think the influence of Japanese bar culture and kind of cocktail bar culture has had a huge effect all around the world. So you have bartenders from certainly from the US, certainly from Europe, going over to Japan, learning, watching, bringing back techniques. You know, the fact that people over here have things like ice programs, all of that's coming from Japan. Shaking techniques, that's all coming from Japan, even though quite often the wrong type of shakers used, but that's kind of drifting in there. But I think, and I think perhaps the most important element of it is this idea that if you walk into a Japanese bar, or three of us walk into a Japanese bar, and you know I'm drinking water, you're drinking a cocktail, and our friend is drinking a whiskey, the water will be served with the same attention to detail as the whiskey, as the cocktail. And the sense of hospitality and the sense of making the best drink that you can at that particular point comes across. And also, it is the drink which is important, so it's not ego. So, you know, Western bartending tends to be more kind of ego-driven. You know, I'm the bartender, this is what I'm doing, etc. And that's fine, because that's part of, you know, our particular culture. But I think the way in which the drink becomes the most important thing in Japan is really important. And that also kind of resonates with whiskey itself. I talked to a few bartenders in the book. I didn't have enough space to have everybody in there. But, you know, some of the discussions we went, again, just went significantly deeper than I ever thought, ever imagined. You know, like the symbolism of an ice ball. Mm. You know, it's not just a ball of ice, it's actually symbolizing time. You know, it's mad. Wow. You have to buy the book to get that one.
When you come back, we can talk about them too.
It's really important, you know, that it's like the whiskey itself, you know, it's allowing the whiskey to speak, you know, and not kind of.
So bartenders are also part of whiskey, though, the way of whiskey.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And I have one more quick question about, sure. You know, I don't think you can talk about Japanese whiskey without talking about highballs.
Sure.
So what is highball? Why is so important?
Highball's quite simply, it's a whiskey and soda. And really, there's been this kind of highball revolution that's taken whiskey by storm in Japan. So Japanese whiskey industry went into like 25 years of decline from the mid-80s onwards. And various things were trying to try and revive it in the domestic market. It wasn't working. A new generation was drinking shochu instead of whiskey. And then Suntory realized that there was a couple of bars that were selling huge amounts of whiskey and went and investigated why they were selling so much and realised they were making good old-fashioned highballs. And that was Rockfish, which is in Shimbashi, and Samboa in Osaka. And Suntory at that point went, OK, let's test this out in izakaya across Japan. And suddenly everybody went, wow, where have you been all my life? You know, a new generation trying whiskey in a different serve, because whiskey by that time had been unfashionable, and people were beginning to drink single malts, and they were drinking kind of neat and on the side, and they weren't necessarily social. They were kind of, you know, very focused, and everything's very quiet, very serious. And suddenly you've got a celebratory drink, you know, that you can drink, especially, you know, and it's cooling and it's refreshing and it's low in alcohol, so you can drink it all the way with food. Right. And it's kind of ticking all the boxes for today's drinker, and also for the original principles of Japanese whiskey making, which was make something lighter to go with food.
That's
just taken off. So you can get amazing highballs in very high-end restaurants, and you can get, you know, half pints of highballs on draft in izakaya. And it's wonderful. It's such a great drink.
Right.
You know, I think that's the important thing. It's
food. With whiskey, which is not seen here.
No, and that was kind of one of the things that Tori-san did in 1928 after the first whiskey failed because it was too heavy and too Scotch-like. He said, well, you know, if Japanese whiskey is to succeed, it has to fit in with the climate and with the food, and people are going to be drinking it with the meal. And that means you're not going to be drinking hard liquor, neat hard liquor, all the way through a meal. You know, and that's a pretty tough ask.
Right.
But if you have a really fascinating, complex drink, which still stands up to dilution, you know, to a strength which is more or less like a glass of wine, to be honest, it's something which is cooling, refreshing, and also will accompany food very nicely. So it kind of works in two different dimensions, really.
Mm.
It's also a great reset. You know, after a pretty hard day's work, you walk into a bar and you sit down, you have a highball, you go, right, okay, but the evening starts here.
Mm. Right. So, well, listeners, you haven't tried a highball. I think highballs started to be served here in this country too.
Yes, yeah, they are. You know, there's various highball machines, you know. And people ask me, oh, my goodness, how do you make it? Well, you know, it's quite easy. You take some whiskey and you have a tall glass and you add ice, but good ice, and top it up with soda water. So either 2-1 or 3-1. If you wanted to move it into kind of rockfish Samboa territory, put your whiskey in the freezer, so have it really cold, have the glasses really cold, and that means you don't need to use the ice, have the soda really cold, and it's just a wonderfully refreshing drink.
Mm, that's a great idea, actually.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah. Wow, so it's a perfect for spring and summer.
Perfect.
Okay. In your book, you express your endless curiosity about Japanese whiskey. So what's your plan? Are you going to keep working with Japanese distilleries?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this isn't the end. This is the opening up of a new chapter, new distilleries starting up. What's going to happen next? There's so many exciting things taking place in Japan at the moment because, you know, whiskey is in short supply. You know, there's not a huge amount of mature stock because the industry had gone into a long period of decline. So there's not a huge amount of mature stock. But what is being made now is again slightly different to what was being made a few years back. So I think there's lots of new flavors and lots of new techniques and lots of new opportunities and openings for whiskey as it moves forward. So nothing is ever finished.
Okay, you know? So hopefully this was going to be the first episode with you, and then you can keep coming back.
I sincerely hope so. Thank you.
Right. Okay, and where can we find your update online, and also where can find your book?
The book will be available through all good independent booksellers and, of course, online in various large retail. I don't know if you're allowed to mention things. I'm coming from Britain, where you're not allowed to mention companies. But it's readily available. Thank you. I have a family to support, so every donation is gratefully received. I'm not on Facebook. I defaced myself a good few years ago. It's very liberating, folks. You should try it. But I am on Instagram as Dave Wasabi, and I'm on Twitter as Dave Broom Whiskey.
Great. Wonderful. So listeners, The Way of Whiskey is one of the greatest books ever read about Japanese culture, not to mention the depths of Japanese whiskey culture. So I highly recommend that to take a look at it. And the picture's amazing.
Yeah. Itaki is just an amazing photographer. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or the suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer is David Tadesiore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.